Thank you, Paula, for the introduction, and thank you all for coming out and braving the elements. Although, compared to yesterday, this is a balmy day, but I guess 16 being balmy is only something that can happen here in the Chicago area. I want to talk this evening. You know, oftentimes I find myself thinking about what it is I would like to talk about, you know, what level it is I would like for us to have this time to share about. And now this one about pain and healing, which is one of those constant things, I guess, for everybody. Some level or another, we have to address that. Was something that made sense to me as a subject to consider. Largely because just very recently, for the very first time in my life, I had some sort of a surgical procedure. And so I had an operation on my shoulder. And as anyone who has experienced the whole, that realm of medical practice, you know that there is a certain amount of pain that is involved with that. And so you end up having to, it's something that, whether you want it or not, finds its way into your thought. And whether you want it or not, you find that you have to think about ways to deal with it. And so, you know, there are a variety of strategies, and there are a variety of things that do work, a variety of things that don't work, and a whole bunch of things in the middle. So it seemed like something that I thought would be good to explore, largely because, you know, obviously I was not the first person to experience pain. It's one of those things that has a universal quality to it. If you're a human being, well, if you are a sentient being, then it's something that is our experience somewhere along the line. In fact, all the way along the line, it's just a matter of the degree. So, you know, that's something that kind of impressed itself on my thinking. So to start off with, we'll talk about the subject of pain. Pain as, first, probably it'd be best to consider just from the physical standpoint. Because really there is this hierarchy of pain as there is this hierarchy of healing. So just at the level of the physical dimension, I guess something that would pass for a suitable explanation, suitable definition of what pain might be, would be a sensory or an emotional experience of, that is always unpleasant, that is related to either actual or potential damage to tissue. I mean, that's the pure physical. If something's getting damaged or about to be, the response to it is this thing that we end up calling pain. Obviously, it takes place on other levels as well, and we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about some of those as well. But just building from that as a definition, and probably we want to separate two ideas that we tend to, I guess the term is we tend to conflate. We tend to put them both together. There's this idea of pain, and then there is this idea of suffering. And those are two things that we tend to think of as, you know, you say one and it tends to mean the other. Obviously, they're very closely related, but they are not necessarily identical. So the difference being perhaps pain really is, you could narrow it down to a sensory experience. You know, I stick my finger in the fire, something happens with that that I call pain. It's not necessarily suffering. What brings in the part of suffering is the mental attitude that we then apply to that experience. Pain in and of itself is rather neutral. But then when we have this attitude of wanting to avoid it, sadness over what has happened to our body, expectation of its occurrence at a future time, a sense that somehow it identifies our mortality, then it takes on this additional quality that then is termed suffering. Actually, in Buddhist thinking, they have this idea that there are three, well, first of all, suffering is something that is described as the universal experience of conscious beings. So that's the groundwork. But then they also say that there are three particular forms that it takes. Obviously, each one covers a broad spectrum. But they would say there is gross suffering, which really relates to this whole area of, you know, physical pain and the things that go around that. So there's gross suffering. There is the suffering of change, which is to say that, you know, as we live, we recognize that anything that we try to hold on to somehow has this quality of shifting on us. And there is no thing that is uniform and constant. So, you know, as much as I might like ice cream, if I find myself just indulging in ice cream, suddenly this joy becomes a pain and a bloating and an expense because I like Haagen-Dazs. So the suffering of change. And then there's this other category, which is much more kind of nebulous, which is to say they call it pervasive suffering. Pervasive suffering that is based on our conditioning. So we'll go into some of that as we go along. But first, let's just talk about the normal experience of putting my hand near a fire. And what is it that's actually happening in the physical body when that occurs? I mean, these are things that are studied, and these are things that a great deal of research has been done on. So it's something that is described from a scientific perspective with quite a bit of accuracy, the process. So the way it works, there are two things that we need to keep in mind throughout this whole evening's discussion. The first one, when we consider pain, is that essentially what is described as pain is an energetic experience. It relates to energy. It's not just a material thing. There's an energetic quality to it. And within the human body, the mechanism for the experience of this, for the signaling of this pain to the brain and to the consciousness, the mechanism is described as electrochemical. You know, two different forms of energy are involved. So what happens is this. I touch a fire, and there's a certain type of nerve throughout the human body. Largely, they tend to end in the extremities of the body, in the skin. And they're called nociceptors, nociceptor nerves. And these are the nerves that conduct the experience of pain through the nerve to the spinal column and then to the brain. So this is something that's tracked quite, you know, accurately by conventional science. So what occurs is this. The tissue becomes damaged by the fire, or the impression, or it can happen from fire, pressure, chemical, any of those things. There are these same sorts of nerves to detect all of those. So as the tissue experiences some degree of damage or the approach to it, it starts to emit certain chemicals. And these chemicals are sensed by the neurons, by the nerves, these nociceptor nerves. And from that point, the transmission of this signal of impending pain or pain starts to go down the nerve to the spinal column and then up to the brain. But really, it's even more remarkable than just that, because my conventional thinking about it, when I thought about nerve, I went to this exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry when it was here in town. And I forget what it was called, but it was something about bodies. So they had these dissections almost of human bodies, of horses. You know, they'd have like an athlete and he's running, but it's like a skeletal athlete. But then in some of them, they would show the nervous, you know, the nerves. And somehow I had it in my mind that these nerves were these little, you know, these little tiny things that kind of spread through the body. But you have these big cords that contain, you know, hundreds of thousands of these nerve cells, and then they're branchings off from there. So I had this idea that, you know, somehow there's this uniform string, and when, you know, fire hits here, it just goes up the string. You know, just like used to talk as kids where you had a tin can at each end and a string, and if you stretched it tight, you could hear the other person. So that was my vision of how this nervous thing worked. But obviously, there's more to it than that. Because it's not just one thing, a nerve. It's countless thousands of individual cells that are not joined together at all. You know, there are spaces between them. They touch in places, and it's where they touch that the one cell communicates to the other, and the message is passed along. And where they touch, from the scientific perspective, what they observe is the thing that allows this electrical impulse to pass through it is the particular sort of a chemical reaction at each one. So there's these little gateways that open and allow the nerve to conduct this signal all the way down the nerve, up the spinal column, and in a physical sense, then ending in the brain. So that's the, you know, that's the mechanics of it. And from the conventional scientific point of view, once it reached the brain, that's kind of where the trail ends. So from that perspective, the response that is elicited, which is this reaction to pain, they say that that's where consciousness originates. So that's one view, one that I would suggest is a limited view. And I wouldn't say incorrect, because as far as it goes, it is correct. So anyway, the two things we need to keep in mind. Pain is an energetic phenomenon. And the second thing that is perhaps most important is that it's a phenomenon related to consciousness. There is something that perceives this impression that we describe as pain. And that's something we tend to describe as I. I feel pain. I respond to this feeling. The center of consciousness is the all-important player in all of this. Okay, so there's this level of physical pain. And one of the things that we observe, the experience that we describe as pain is something that is really isolated to any being, any life form that has a nervous system. In the absence of a nervous system, there is not this degree, there's not this thing that we would call pain. So you have minerals, you have plants, and they don't have these nervous systems. It's not to say that they don't feel, because there's been a host of experiments done with plants in particular. My daughter did one when she was in high school, where she was raising seeds, and she played bad music. And I won't say what's bad music, because she might get mad at me. Bad music to one set of seeds, more sort of soothing music to another set, and then nothing at all to a third. And, you know, just watch them sprout. And after a certain period of time, it was quite identifiable that the ones that had been exposed to sort of dissonant music were really dwarfed in comparison to the others. And the ones in between, you know, they grew, and sometimes it seemed like it might have been a little close to this one, but this one was clearly stunted in its growth. And there's a host of experiments that have been done like that, where they would, you know, clip sensors to a plant to kind of sense the flow of the sort of electrical current within the plant. And they would do things like speak badly to the plant. One experiment, they took these, there's a type of shrimp, little bitty shrimp, that they feed to tropical fish. So they took these shrimp, and in front with the plant here, they had boiling water here. And they brought the shrimp over near to the water, and then they could see how there was a sort of wilting effect that took place with the electrical current within the plant. So there's a sentience with plants. There's a sentience with minerals. I mean, minerals respond to pressure, to heat. But it's nothing that we could describe as the pain that animals and human beings experience. So really, when you come to a subject like, vegetarianism, for people who are vegetarians, who are not vegetarians only because of the benefits to their own personal health, there are people who adopt that sort of lifestyle, that sort of way of eating, not just because of the research that demonstrates that it's a healthier sort of diet, but there are people who adopt it for moral reasons. And the foundation for that sort of morality is this whole idea that those sorts of people do not eat animals because of the necessary pain that it has to be inflicted in taking its life and putting it on the plate. So that's the moral basis for something like that. So physical pain goes through this sort of nervous channel. Now there's a deeper way of looking at that as well, which is the view that theosophy and the ageless wisdom would propose. That beyond just the transfer of electrical energy down a physical nerve to the brain, that there's something more that's going on. The premise would be this, that we as human beings are, really, we're multi-dimensional beings. We are not just physical beings subject to physical processes. So that idea would say this, that really what is happening, that the real transfer of energy is the energy that is described as prana. Is that a term that's familiar to most? I mean, it's not an unfamiliar term. Prana, or Chinese tradition would call it qi, that's the energetic form, the energy that is transmitted, but that the means of transmission is something that's beyond just a purely physical body. There's the idea that each one of us, in addition to this material sort of body, there's another one that is closely related to this, which is often described as the etheric body or the health body or the energetic body. In Indian spirituality, it's described as the linga sharira or the model body. And the basic idea for that is that it's material as well, but it's just slightly finer sorts of material. It's something that many people, you know, it doesn't take any special sort of clairvoyance for people to be able to actually see this. Because from time to time, if somebody's standing, you know, with the appropriate background, and if somebody can actually look and relax their eyes as they look, very often you'll see, you know, like a bluish, perhaps a bluish gray, just exactly mimicking the form of the body, extending out from it maybe, you know, a quarter inch, an inch. And a lot of people see that. It's not uncommon at all, and it's not something that shows some that it's time for you to become a guru. It's just very natural. But this is the energy body, the etheric body. And it's through this body that the prana is conducted. So the same thing that occurs when you touch the flame, the prana is conducted through the body, through the etheric body, and then actually the etheric body is the conduit to what's described as the astral body, which is where the actual sensation of pain takes place and is then referred to the brain. So this is the actual process that is described. The brain's function is really to transmit and to receive. But the source of consciousness is hardly the brain. No more than, you know, if you have a TV at home and you turn it to a particular channel, I don't think any one of us is going to think that the TV has created suddenly the Seinfeld show. You know, neither does the brain create the impressions that come into it. It's just strictly a receiver. And you'll find that people who have damage to the brain, normal, what we would look at as normal source of reception, is impaired. So that's something that we witness. So there is this whole dimension of the physical pain and the physical body. Probably for most of us, when we think about the experience of that which is painful, it doesn't just end at the burns and the cuts and the normal things that we do during the course of a day. Probably for most of us, there's another dimension, you know, a second sort of level, which could be described more as emotional or psychic sorts of pain or discomfort. And you know, that's the normal experience for many people. And actually, there's this whole range of medical practice that has evolved around what's often described as psychosomatic medicine. And you know, they find that there are categories of particular things that often are the results of emotional sorts of issues that we have. So, you know, very often, if you go to a doctor and you seem to have some sort of recurring low back pain that they can't find a physical cause for, very often they have found that that's something that is subject to stress. High blood pressure, that's a physical symptom that very often has a stress related, not always, of course, but very often it's something that has stress related. So there's this whole realm of psychic or emotional pain that many people experience. And, you know, why? The water's far away. Probably, when we think about this sort of thing, there isn't a person alive that does not encounter a variety of emotional sorts of inputs during the course of any given day. And really what distinguishes whether or not it develops into something that causes us discomfort or unpleasantness or irritation is really our response to that. There's an idea that much of what we experience in this realm is the result of energy, chi, prana, that somehow becomes congested. It doesn't flow. So the idea being that an ordinary healthy person, the thing that distinguishes us as healthy is that there is a the energies that keep this body alive and that keep it moving flow without being impeded, without being congested. But that when we experience certain sorts of emotional trauma, perhaps, that the energy becomes locked, frozen, ceases to flow. And a lot of examples are given. I very much like the work that there's a fellow, a theosophist in the Philippines, Vikhao Chin. He's doing absolutely wonderful things. A lot of it around this whole level of self-help. So he would give the example, for instance, of people who have a phobia of, I mean, you pick it, snakes is one that he works with a lot. A lot of people do not like snakes for whatever reason. I guess they took the Bible seriously, that bad fellow, you know, back in Genesis. So maybe that's where it has its roots. But then other people just, for whatever reason, somewhere along the line, they heard that they're poisonous, they're bad, and then just the sight of them, they develop a fear. And the way those things work, this fear arises, and then before you know it, you're having a conversation with someone and it sort of dies down. So there's this blockage to the flow of energy that occurs with this fear. And then it sort of goes away. But it's never really addressed. And so the next time we see a snake, it rises up again. And so it starts to get more and more and more congested. So what he has developed is an approach which is almost counterintuitive, except that it's so effective. And the idea is this, that anytime we experience one of these emotional sorts of flare-ups, whether it be anger, fear, whatever the emotion may be, that if we really look at it, if we can become slightly aware, we become aware that we actually also experience it somewhere in our bodies. So, you know, when you get angry, you start to notice that your head heats up. You know, they call them hot-headed people. But it's true. Now, you'll notice that there's a heat that rises. You know, often you'll notice that you're clenching your fist. Your voice goes up. But there's this physical sort of response. And so what he did was this, which I thought was quite brilliant. Using meditative sorts of, you know, basic sort of mindfulness techniques, the idea is that you would focus on this unpleasant sensation. So if you feel something as a burning in the pit of your stomach when you're getting angry, rather than focusing on the person that you're directing it toward, you actually turn your attention to where you're feeling it in your body, because that's an actual experience. You know, the way he would put it is that there is this first level of experience, and then there's a secondary level. So if I get angry at somebody, I can start saying, well, it's because, you know, I'm angry at this guy because he cut in front of me with his car, the rascal. Start to get angry about that. That's a secondary level. It's a description of something that's outside. But the actual experience of the anger is something that's taking place within the body. And so the idea then, you turn your attention toward that, and then a simple technique of just breathing, you know, focused breathing. And what you find is this, and it's quite, if you work with it, it's something that's rather surprising in a way, but so effective. You start to find that wherever you focus on that area, whether it's the pit of your stomach, your throat, your head, whatever it is, say the pit of the stomach. As you breathe, you become very much aware of the sensation that has arisen there. And as you keep breathing, something starts to happen. Sometimes what you notice is, if you track it, you'll find that it may move. You know, so what started out here, you know, now is moved in another direction. And as you keep following it, you'll find that it dissipates, and sometimes you find that it actually, you know, there's certain sorts of channels that it goes out of. And basically, there are these channels in the human body, these energetic channels, that have been identified for thousands of years. In India, they speak about the nadis. You know, the nadis are these channels. In the acupuncture, they talk about the meridians. So there are these meridians, this sort of energy map within the body, much like the nerves are a physical map, along which these energies flow. And this method of focusing is one that allows them to dissipate, and actually is one that allows them to dissipate in a way where they don't necessarily return. So to me, this approach to dealing with this kind of emotional pain that people experience is one that has great, great value. All right, so that's the pain part. Now maybe let's talk a little bit about healing. So what we have here, when we talk about healing, when we are healthy, the word itself means whole, like complete. Health is related to wholeness. So those things that create some sort of separateness or some sort of division within the functioning of the body or the psyche are those things that described as unhealthy or, if persisted in long enough, disease. So just at the level of the physical body, as I said, conventional science has a wonderful way of describing the processes, the symptoms. But really, if you really look at it, it goes so far and really no farther, because it does not really speak to anything about the why. It describes a how to some degree, but it doesn't really say much about the why. Why does the body have this sort of intelligence that it's able to maintain itself? The term they use is homeostasis. That every single body, every one of us in this room, unless you're suffering from a severe fever right now, your body temperature is somewhere between 96 and 99 degrees. Every one of us is within this, like, very small band of temperature. And that doesn't strike people as unusual or miraculous. It's just the state of, you know, it's what we call being human. That the chemical composition of the blood, if you're going to remain healthy, is within certain very tight ranges. That everybody, if they're going to remain healthy, this homeostasis process makes certain that you sleep at night, or that you sleep whenever you sleep. But the body requires a certain amount of rest, that the pressure within the body has to be regulated and maintained, and that when it goes out of that range, the body works to bring it back to that range. That's what's described. But the term intelligence is not one that is applied to that. It's just a description of something going on. So that's the nature of the human condition. So the body has a natural tendency to heal itself. And given an opportunity, it will. So what is it that we do, you know, to heal? Again, at the purely mechanical level, you know, if there's something wrong, there's a point of view that what we need to do is either cut it out or poison it. You know, you think in terms of surgery and you think in terms of medications, which have their place. I mean, believe me, I went in for surgery. And, you know, before I couldn't do this, now I can reach up to the ceiling. It's a wonderful thing when applied properly. But the quick results that it gives are the sorts of things that we then seek out in other directions, which it's not reasonable to do. So cut it or poison it, some call it slash and burn, is one approach. But then there are all of these other approaches, which to me, it's remarkable in a way that probably one of the greatest secrets is really a completely wide open secret. That this whole idea I was talking about energy, about consciousness, in the realm of healing, it's one of those areas where there has been so much scientific research that has demonstrated the efficacy of something like therapeutic touch, Reiki. You know, those energetic practices where somebody stands next to you, doesn't touch you, but an energy transfers. And when the experimentation has been done, they find that the blood pressure lowers, that the hemoglobin rate raises. You know, there are all of these sorts of consequences that are observable, that you can calculate, but it's not part of the conventional approach, even though it's been tested and proven so many times. Prayer. I mean, prayer is something that people tend to relegate to the churches and, you know, those type of folks. There has been so much experimentation done that has demonstrated, without any sort of doubt, I mean, from a scientific point of view, the models for the experiment have been correct. The outcomes have demonstrated that in groups that have people who don't know them, who aren't anywhere near them, who focus prayer toward recovery from surgery, for instance, you'll have a group that's being prayed for, a group that is not. And the rate of healing, it's statistical. And so it's not something that there's any doubt about that. What is in doubt is, you know, what's the mechanism? If it can't be observed in the normal scientific way, it tends to be dismissed in spite of the fact. So, and I should say, if you have any interest in following up on any of these sorts of things, there's a fellow by the name of Larry Dossey who has done a lot of, Dr. Larry Dossey, he's done an awful lot of work with research into prayer from a scientific perspective, and he has a lot of references to things like that. Therapeutic touch, you can find references to that as well. So there's this level of energetic, there's this level of super or extra physical healing that takes place. At the level of the mind is another one of those areas that is demonstrated in terms of the ability to heal. In fact, the thing that got Larry Dossey started on his study, he was born and he was raised in a very religious family. But when he went to college, he decided, I'm through with all of that. And he went into his medical practice. And that was where he was coming from. But he started to see that there were all these cases of people who would come in who had received no treatment because their disease was beyond treating, who then would have these complete remissions. And the only thing they would point to is that, you know, the people at my church were praying for me, or the people in my mosque were praying for me, or the Theosophical Healing Group was praying for him. There are a lot of those. So he started to get interested, and then he started this sort of experimentation. But I remember, you know, it comes to my mind now because this fellow just died, and I think he really was one of the very, very great people in the world. You know, in my life, you know, in this part of my life, there have been two people who I really wanted to meet. and be able to spend some time trying to see what it is that they had inside of them. And one of them was the Dalai Lama. And the other one was this fellow Nelson Mandela, who just died, you know, a week or so ago. And him, because, you know, the Dalai Lama for obvious sorts of reasons, and Nelson Mandela for, to me at least, equally obvious sorts of reasons, in the sense that this is a guy who was, he spent 27 years of his life in prison. And, you know, not the greatest of conditions either. Targeted for a lot of things, and was able to pass through that particular experience and not just come out unbroken, but come out as a compassionate human being, not just toward the people that he liked, but toward people who had actively abused him. I mean, to me, that's, you know, I like to think that I would respond that way. You know, it's a nice way to envision myself, because I don't have to go through it. But he did. And, you know, people would ask him, how did you do that? You know, how do you go to prison, have people doing every kind of wrong thing to you, and you come out and speak kindly and help those people? What he said was that when you find yourself imprisoned in that sort of way, that really what is required is that you have to have strong convictions. There has to be something profound within you, beyond just your will to survive, that you connect with. And that's what sustains you. And he evolved into this state of having this connection that, you know, all human beings deserve a certain level of treatment. And he was going to live and die for that. There's this example. I also can, this goes back to, you know, the power of the mind. Back when I was growing up, we used to, well, it was really one of those hotbed times. That was the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, you know, the hippies, all that stuff was going on. And it was a habit in my home that when we would have dinner, because there was so much going on, they would have the news on. So we'd be eating and watching the news. So that period of my childhood, you know, was filled with all of these images of things that were going on with the Vietnam War, with people getting sprayed with hoses in the streets of Mississippi, dogs and all that. And I remember there was a couple of things. One of which, there was a fellow by the name of Andrew Young, who was a real, you know, he was involved with Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. He was one of these young guys. You know, he was one of these college guys who was out there and really going to put everything into it. And they were going out there picketing, protesting, getting arrested. And this one time they took him and they threw him into a paddy wagon. And he was describing how there was just a bunch of them. And they took him and they just packed him into this paddy wagon. So it was just standing room only, and closed the door on it. And they were going apparently to get more, and they forgot about this particular paddy wagon that was sitting out in the middle of the hot Mississippi sun. And he said as they sat there, it kept getting hotter and hotter, and the air started to seem like it's getting sucked out of the thing, and people were just starting to get ready to panic. And so he said, wait a minute, everybody, wait a minute. And he started singing a song. You know, there are a lot of songs involved in the civil rights movement, but this particular one was a song by Hank Williams. He was a country guy. It was a song called Cool Water. Cool Water. And he said they started to sing this song about, oh, water, cool, clear water. You know? And they kept singing. And he said as they sang it, everybody in there felt the temperature drop. They started singing louder and louder. You know, eventually they came and took them off to jail, which I guess they were happy about that. But again, the mind and its capacity to go beyond physical circumstances. When we're looking at the roots, you know, the real source of healing, pills have their effect, obviously. They give us a break. They give us a temporary relief from the symptom that allows the body to recover. But there's this hierarchy of healing that begins with the physical, goes to the mind, and then probably there's a third type of pain and a third type of healing that really is sort of out of the realm of all of these other ones that we've talked about. This third pain, which probably is not the condition of everybody, it may not be the condition of many, but I would venture to say that for all of us, at some point, it becomes really the focal point of our experience. The way the pain was described by St. Augustine, he used this phrase that our hearts are ever restless until they find rest in thee. He was coming from the religious perspective. That there is something within us that has this sense that we are somehow disconnected from something much greater. Something that really is the basis and the reason and the purpose of our being. And as I say, that's not everybody's awareness, that's not everybody's sense. But at a certain point, with many, it is something that becomes quite important. It's spoken of as divine discontent. And really, I would describe this pain, this longing. You could call it existential, or you could call it mystical or spiritual, but it's a longing for something beyond. Something beyond our normal day-to-day experience. Something beyond what is described as our captivation with the realm of illusion. And the certainty that there is, in fact, that something that lies there. So then, for that sort of person, you find them sort of plagued by these hounds of heaven that are continually nipping at them until they head in the right direction. And that's a whole nother path that opens itself up. And I do believe that really, when we think in terms of healing, that probably the most profound sorts of healings that take place really take place as we are able to experience this dimension of our own being. You know, the union with the divine that's often spoken of. And certainly for anyone who has had this sort of moment of illumination, you know, you're not worrying about the bunions on your feet or the sore knee that's been bothering you from day to day. It may still be sore. But the healing that takes place, the wholeness that is the nature of this sort of experience, is what's described by many as really the goal of living and something that's worth pursuing. So that's this third pain, this third healing. So pretty much I think that's about, you know, that's about the ground that I came here to cover this evening. Open to questions or open to your comments. I want to thank you for being attentive. I guess it beats being out in the cold.
I think my religious background, I heard a story once similar to what you were saying, and they say all of us are born with a hole in our heart, and we try to fill it with all these other things, different people, foods, stuff, but it's the connection with God is what truly fills it. And but it's a longing, you know, we know we're looking for something, mm-hmm. and it's interesting when you find it.
Yeah. And I think that's the way it's described. Particularly, there are a number of ways of describing it, but from the religious perspective, certainly it's a longing for reconnecting with God.
I wanted to just share my experience. This was 2006. I was told, I had some pain. I went to get it all checked out. And then they went down here and they said, oh, you have precancer of the esophagus at the juncture of the stomach. Mm-hmm. And that was a year I was really angry. I had been angry all year at a relative who wasn't helping me with my mom, who was supposed to be helping me. And then I was so afraid I was going to have this terrible cancer. And then it dawned on me, wait, that's the solar plexus? I need to meditate more. So I started meditating almost daily and for longer than I have been. And a year later, my doctor forced me to go to one of the top gastroenterologists in the Chicago area at University of Chicago. He could not find a trace of high-grade dysplasia, low-grade dysplasia. Sure. They were so worried, they got my slides from the other hospital, and then they were telling me, we need to go down there every 3 months because you've got Barrett's esophagus. I said, you're never going down there again. So it really, that kind of stuff can really happen, and when you experience it, you realize, wow, I guess I'm my own worst enemy by how I respond and not calming myself down.
And your own best friend.
I recently read an article on the healing effects of humor.
Now there is a whole, and that's actually something that's practiced in medical settings as well. That fellow Norman, Dr. Norman Cousins, he's mostly credited with that. Healed himself of a...
He laughed himself well.
Yeah. But, you know, again, people start cracking up and watching funny movies, and they notice changes in the body chemistry. The mind, so many things are directly impacted by the outer is impacted by the inner. And if we take that sort of perspective, it's a more powerful position to be in, actually.
Just wanted to share something that came to my mind when you were talking about having the experience of the higher realms and the process of healing while doing so. In the Egyptian traditions, in the ancient times, there was something called sleeping in the temple, a night in the temple. And what happened there was, as far as I remember from my crazy readings, is that these initiates would take the disciples who were ill and would bring them to these astral and higher realms and bring them to wholeness with the higher experiences. Yeah. But then they had these obstacles that they weren't able to bring these experiences into their daily life, right? So the healing was not complete. So while in the temple, everything was fine. But when they went back home, the illness would go right behind them. Mm-hmm. So some of them, of course, healed completely because they were able to, but the majority weren't. So I have a question about this. How can we make this bridge in our daily life? Because obviously, not all of us are disciples or initiates of any sort. We are ordinary people, and yet we have access to these realms like anyone else. So how can we establish this balance and be whole? I know that it's very difficult, but do you have any suggestions about it?
Yeah. I think a lot of this stuff begins with awareness. There's this African saying that the disease that is hidden cannot be cured. So until it actually becomes exposed to awareness, there is no cure for any disease. And so then, of course, there are levels of awareness, as we were talking about with anger, for instance. You know, there's anger as the words you say, and then there's also anger as the experience within the body. And so it's this sort of a ever more discriminating point of view. Ultimately, I think it's all about our awareness. But the other thing I have to say is that every condition does not necessarily change into what we would project as being healthy. You know, so the fact that damage is done to a part of the body, you can think and think and think, and you can be aware as you want to be. Sometimes that part of the body is damaged for life. And to some, they would say that, okay, then I'm not healthy. But again, if the limits of health are the physical body, you'll never be healthy because there'll always be something wrong. But I have known, we have all known, people who have had, you know, lifelong painful sorts of body deformities or things that have happened to their bodies, yet who have been some of the friendliest, most sought out people around. My wife had a woman who was a very recognized and profound teacher who was actually, she was completely, she was deformed. She was bent over and hunched. And in that particular culture, you know, the normal things of life weren't open to her because nobody was going, she was not going to have a family. She was not going to be chosen by anyone in that respect. But she was this woman who had this sort of wisdom that everyone came to. And she was, in fact, herself a healer of great note. So the interpretation of health, when it's only linked to the body, first of all, you're not healthy if you're starting off with that idea. But then the second thing is that very often the greatest healing that can take place is to leave this body. Doctors very often are plagued with depression because they are unable to keep somebody alive because it's a sign of failure and it's something that seems to have been, you know, the worst thing that could happen in their profession. But again, there are things that are a whole lot worse than dying. And I would suggest that perhaps one of them is underliving. Underliving your life is worse than leaving it. Because until you start to actually live up to your actual potential, basically you're just taking up space here. And we all have those things. I mean, we're all in that category. But I think that's just a different perspective on health sometimes.
Very, very touching experience. I went to a place to do some service, and there was a person who was helping me there who I was completely in shock when I saw her because all her throat was completely teared apart, almost. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was healed already, and it was cicatrized. I mean, like a, how do you say in English? Like a healed. The skin was not bleed or anything, just cured completely. But you could tell that her whole body was deformed by this. Yet this person had such a disposition for helping and serving. Mm-hmm. And her voice was the sweetest voice I've ever heard in my whole entire life. And her ways of just directing us to whatever we were doing, I was just like, I just could not look at her deformity. And of course, it's a woman in the middle of her chest and breast here, all of it was just turned apart. And the first thing you notice is just, you just want to look at that thing. But I could not help just to looking at her eyes and just, I was just enamored by this wonderful being there. So how could she transcend that? And yet it was not there, but something else. And, you know, that's all it took place there. Mm-hmm.
What role do you think having compassion for other people plays in your own healing?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that actually they, again, this is scientific sort of experimentation. There's a fellow by the name of Dr. Richard Davidson. Up at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. And he's one of these people who's doing a lot of, he's in that mind science group with the Dalai Lama. So he's had access to all of these different monks who have this advanced meditators. But one of the things he had started doing is training people with a variety of conditions, just normal people, and no experience with meditation, training them to do what's described as a simple metta meditation, you know, which metta is basically loving kindness. So, you know, the way it works as a visualization and in the mind is that you call to mind, you know, first of all, yourself, and you wish good things for yourself, security, happiness, all that. And then you call to mind people who are near to you. Then you call to mind people who are neutral. Then you call to mind people who you have difficulties with. And gradually you start to extend your scope of being able to allow this sense of loving kindness to move through your consciousness and out toward others. Ultimately, it's an exercise in compassion. And so it's an exercise that people do, and they train for a certain number of hours. And that in and of itself is great. But then, of course, what they start finding, because this is a test group, is the implications for their personal health. And that they are things that can be measured and tracked. It's an improvement, invariably, by sitting down, doing nothing. I mean, you're not pumping iron. Essentially, you're sitting down doing nothing that's observable, and your health improves. And then if you turn it toward others specifically, you start to find that those others that you include in that, who don't even know you're doing it, their health improves. And I think it's just the nature of a different type of awareness. There is this mechanical view that a human being is a mechanism subject to physical rules. That's one view. And there's a whole body of science and a whole body of medicine and healing that applies to that. There's a view that says that this is an energetic world and that we share energies. And so there's a whole realm of healing that applies to that. And then there's also this view that says that really there is, in fact, one life, undivided, essentially. But we find ways to create these sorts of divisions. But to the person who sort of adopts that approach, that's where this whole compassion, you know, as a concept first comes in. Compassion, you know, essentially is expanding our boundaries by including others, and then multiples of others, and then limitless others. And so to the one who actually practices that, invariably, it's one of the facts of what you could say the spiritual life, that unfailingly, anyone who practices along this line, anyone who has any degree of some sort of actual illumination becomes a healer, necessarily. It's not to say you're going to put your hand on someone and leprosy is going to disappear. It might. But it is certainly to say that when you find yourself able to kind of enter and establish this state that approaches at least an appreciation of unity, you walk into that room and the energy changes. You come to that Thanksgiving dinner that is traditionally sort of hellish, and your avenue of response has shifted, the energy of all shift, and that there are deepening and deepening layers that we can cultivate within ourselves with that. And it's also a necessity that as we heal others, we also heal ourselves. So even if you want to do it for selfish reasons, it's a good reason.
I'd like to go back to Dee's comment with the people being healed within the temple. And then when they left the temple, the disease followed them. Mm-hmm. And I would suspect that they were never healed to begin with, but simply diverted. But then my question becomes, how do you get anybody to focus on what the disease is. Like you mentioned the situation with Chen in the Philippines. I think it was Chen.
Yeah, Bicao Chen.
And he was indicating, you know, that you actually turn and focus on that pain. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure exactly how you do that, but that sounds like a reasonable thing to do.
One of the, you know, when you start to look at it from an inner side, a lot of what appears as disease, or a lot of what appears as, just habits of mind even, are things that have been cultivated over long periods of time. So, you know, without thinking about it, we find ourselves, having some sort of experience and then feeling some sense of either anger or regret or something. And then we find ourselves very easily repeating those things. And so if you wanted to describe it in a physical way, it's almost as if we cut a channel. You know, often you find yourself walking someplace and there's one particular place that people have been walking. And for whatever reason, it's just so much easier to just keep walking along that path. The same sort of things happen with our minds. So basically, if we take this energetic view, in every case, we are creating channels through which this energy flows. And in many ways, it flows in ways that either become congested or that work against health. So when you have someone who actually has the sort of experience that Danelis was talking about, into the temple, uplifted, essentially for that period, finding themselves free from whatever the affliction was, and then leaving that atmosphere, the problem that occurs is that in one episode, it's difficult to erase the patterns of a lifetime, or even lifetimes. And so when you're away from that influence, then what ends up happening is it requires a certain measure of our own application of will. And very often we're not trained in that way. That's why in every religious community, 12-step programs, anywhere you look, they value so highly the community that you surround yourself with. You know, the term in Indian spirituality is Sangha, the community of individuals, because that's the thing that helps to, when you're wandering off, it brings you back to that path that was related to your healing. And in the absence of that, there are those individuals who are quite strong and quite focused who are able to do that. But very often, the ones that we look to who have been able to achieve that sort of thing have not done it alone. And so that's also an important part of all of this. We need, all of us need examples. Ideally, we become that example. But in the interim, we need examples, and we need many of them. Because that's the thing that kind of, it supplies an energy that directs us.
I think that this homeostasis, I thought I was going to die. I had a series of mystical experiences. It totally changed my life, became a different person. Extroverted, and I'd had years, most of my life I had severe depression. But then that was just a beginning, because then I was out of the temple. And my current thing was, I don't know if people know about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but this is something I got into this whole activist thing and getting so upset. And getting even upset here that people don't know about this. And, this is like a test I've been through, and I'm just coming out of it realizing, no, there has to be a different way to handle this other than just pure being angry and protesting. And so I've recommitted to taking care of myself, doing the meditation, being kind to myself, and remembering I need people too. I need this kind of situation here, so. I'm back.
Welcome. Welcome back.